Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
You know, I'm also a happy registered voter, and I want to add that to the introduction from here until November, just as a reminder, one of my proudest definitions.
And so what's on your mind for today, then?
Well, okay, so happy 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment. I have been looking forward to this day and this anniversary since the first time I visited the Women's Rights National Historic Park in Seneca Falls, New York. And it was one of those happenstance things. I'd never heard of it before. But about a decade ago, a little over a decade ago, my husband and I took a trip through upstate New York to the Finger Lakes, where I was actually born. And so I wanted to take my girls up to see the Finger Lakes in upstate New York and all the beautiful scenery. And we went into Seneca. We went into Seneca Falls, and then we came upon the Women's Rights National Historic Park. And when you go through this park, it's, you know, it's a beautiful museum, and they also, the original place of the 1848 Women's Convention, the very first suffragist event in the United States. And they have tons of displays and photos and reenactments of this first convention, and then information about the founding mothers of the suffragist movement, like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott and Martha Wright and Mary McClintock. And I knew none of this. I knew none of this history a decade ago. And ever since then, I have just immersed myself in the history of women's suffragists and the women's movement. And so it's one of my passions. I've been back to the museum 4 different times. I did a show, an interview with a couple of the rangers from there, I think last year, maybe the summer before. And I have been so excited to do the show, especially because it happened to land on the actual anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment. So if you can't tell, too bad you can't all see me. I am so excited I can barely sit in my chair here in my office. And I have way more information about the suffragists and about the passage and ratification of the 19th Amendment than we'll have time to cover. But I hope that I can pique your interest just enough so that you'll do a little more of a deep dive yourself and look at the information and read about some of the founding mothers and some of the fathers who were involved in the movement, and to start questioning kind of what it is we believe to be true, how it is we believe our history unfolded, and question a little bit about what we have been learned and taught to be the way things are, and start to recognize that much of what we see as the way things are is a distortion of the historical reality of the way things actually happened. And so to that end, we're going to talk today about the 19th Amendment. We're going to talk about the suffragist movement. We're going to tap into a couple of the interviews that I did at the Women's Rights National Historic Park, some short clips with some of the rangers talking about some of these founding mothers, and listen to a little music that came out of the time during the suffragist movement. And so for those of you who don't know, and I think we're all, if you're listening to any sort of commentary or read the New York Times, there's been a lot of information published about the 19th Amendment and the passage of the voting rights for women. And it really, you know, began in the early or mid 1800s. And what's interesting about this time is that the abolitionists were you know, busy at work trying to outlaw slavery. And this was an effort that was being pursued by men and women all over the country. A lot of people in the North were gathering for abolitionist conventions. And that's where the original Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott meeting happened, was actually an abolitionist convention. But it's important to understand also in historical context what was happening at that time, because we're moving into the Industrial Revolution. We see, you know, the primary ways that families are making money moving away from agriculture and into industry, into manufacturing. And we're also moving into this progressive era. And what isn't talked about very much is that as we move into the late 1800s, early 1900s, as women are starting to get a little louder and more aggressive with their tactics to have the right to vote passed, there's pushback, which always happens. If you look at any movement, when there is movement forward, there is always pushback and resistance from those who feel they have a lot to lose by any change, or they fear change at all. And so at this time, although the first convention was in 1848, and it took 70 years from that first convention to the actual passage and ratification of the 19th Amendment, as the women's movement, the suffragist movement, gained power in the late 1800s, early 1900s, the pushback from those who were looking at industry as being our primary source of income started noticing that there was a division. Women were not necessarily needed in manufacturing. Men were wanted to go into the manufacturing piece of making things to get the country running. And women were starting to be pushed more, and mostly middle class and upper class women were being pushed away from doing any sort of manufacturing or commercial work, and were being encouraged to move into primarily work in domesticity, being at home. And they actually called it the cult of domesticity, that women were encouraged to find their place in the home, that women's work was supporting men who were out making things and growing the country. And women were to be in the home making life nice for their for the men, basically. So we have these two things happening at once, where women are starting to gain more recognition, more power when it comes to moving towards the right to vote. And then a whole other faction is saying, no, if women move away from their sacred space as caretakers to the family and try to exercise these powers that they're demanding, we will lose the foundation of motherhood or womanhood. And just as an example, Harriet Beecher Stowe, sister Catherine, was an educational reformer. And at this time in the late 1800s, early 1900s, she starts writing a lot about women's place being at home, and that the suffragists were uncouth and were too radical and were threatening the very foundation of family. And she wrote basically that woman is to win everything by peace and love, by making herself so much respected and esteemed and loved that to yield to her opinions and to gratify her wishes would be the free will offering of the heart. But once women begin to feel the promptings of ambition, or that things for her thirst for power, she will lose all of her defenses, all of the sacred protection of religion, of generous promptings, of chivalry, all of the poetry, romantic gallantry depend on woman's refraining and remaining in her place as dependent and defenseless. And so within every movement, whenever there is energy forward, there is energy pushing back. And we see that today with the movements of Black Lives Matter and ongoing push for voting rights and for anyone who's trying to speak out against disenfranchisement. So what a perfect time to talk about the 19th Amendment, because what happened 100 years ago is still being looked at and experienced today. And even after the passage of the 19th Amendment 100 years ago, it wasn't like everything fell into place and women started to vote and laws were changed and life got easier. Actually, right after the passage of the 19th Amendment, the voting, the turnout for women voting was actually quite low. And it remained that way for many decades. And not only was the turnout for women to vote very low, most women voted along the same lines as their husband. So all of these hopes for change that were going to come with the passage of the right to vote were really slow in happening. And another piece of that was after the right to vote, the ratification of the 19th Amendment, it didn't opened doors for African-American women who not only were locked out because of segregation, but they were locked out of voting because of literacy tests and poll taxes. And there wasn't opportunities to register to vote. White women had opportunities to register to vote. Black women, when they would go into the courthouse or to the county to vote, faced long lines or were turned away. And Indigenous women were not recognized as being citizens or having the right to vote for until 1965, same as African-American women. So although this is a historic day and one of the movements forward in our wave of progressive actions for women, we still have work to do. We still have to have these conversations. So today we're going to listen to a few clips, listen to a little music, listen to the Declaration of Sentiments, and hopefully awaken ourselves to what work needs to happen moving forward. And although we won't be taking calls today, you can still be part of the conversation in many ways. If you'd like to share a thought or a comment or a question, you can call us at 805-549-8855, and Sarah will happily pass along the question or comment to me. You can always send me an email to Elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com or find us on our Facebook page or Instagram, Elizabeth_TRT, and leave me a message. And you can follow us by podcasting the show, subscribe by visiting Apple Podcasts or however you find your podcast. Look for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, hit subscribe, and you can listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org and look under the program list. So we're going to start off today with a song from 1916, 4 years before the passage of the 19th Amendment. And it's called She's Good Enough to Be Your Baby's Mother. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We'll be back in a moment to continue our conversation.
Greater than his mother, no man is half so good, no man is better than the wife he loves. Her love will guide him, whatever betide him. He's good enough to love you and adore you. Good enough to bear your troubles for you, and if your tears were falling today, nobody else would kiss them away. She's good enough to warm your heart with kisses when you are lonesome and blue. She's good enough to be your baby's mother. And she's good enough to vote with you.
So that's some angry woman music. She's Good Enough to Be Your Baby's Mother from 1916, right at the height of the social activism that was taking place around the country as women tried to get the right to vote passed. But it wasn't just the right to vote that actually moved the suffragists. There actually was a whole list of different demands that women had, and they were found in the original Declaration of Sentiments that was written by Elizabeth Cady Stanton in 1848. It was actually the cornerstone of that original convention, Women's Rights Convention, that happened in Seneca Falls. And every quarter, I asked my students, please read the Declaration of Sentiments, because although we really focus on the right to vote, the passage of the right to vote wasn't really the cornerstone of this declaration. As a matter of fact, for some of the women who were at the convention, they felt adding the right to vote piece of their demands as being too crazy, too much to ask for, and they wanted to pay attention to some of the others. So although I ask my students every quarter to read this, I don't think many of them ever have. And so today I'm actually going to read to you the Declaration of Sentiments and Resolutions. I'm going to paraphrase a bit of it because it's important to see what these women were talking about in 1848, 170 years ago, and recognize that in many ways, the things that they were demanding have still not been met fully in our Constitution, in our culture, in our community, and by the laws that have and have not been passed. So again, I'm going to paraphrase a bit of it. When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one portion of the family of man to assume among the people of the earth a position different from that which they have hitherto occupied, but one to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes that impel them to such a course. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted, deriving their just powers from the consent of the government. Whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of those who suffer from it to refuse allegiance to it, and to assist upon the institution of a new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of the women under this government, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to demand the equal station to which they are entitled. The history of mankind is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations on the part of man toward woman, having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over her. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. And the following are the actual declarations for women that were written in 1848. He has never permitted her to exercise her inalienable right to be the elective franchise. He has compelled her to submit to laws in the formation of which she had no voice. He has withheld from her rights, which are given to the most ignorant and degraded men, both natives and foreigners. Having deprived her of this first right of a citizen, the elective franchise, thereby leaving her without representation in the halls of legislation, he has oppressed her on all sides. He has made her, if married, in the eye of the law, civilly dead. He has taken from her all right and property, even to the wages she earns. He has made her morally an irresponsible being, as she can commit crimes, many with impunity, provided they be done in the presence of her husband. In the covenant of marriage, she is compelled to promise obedience to her husband, he becoming to all intents and purposes her master, the law giving him power to deprive her of her liberty and to administer chastisement. He has so framed the laws of divorce as to what shall be the proper causes and in case of separation to whom the guardianship of the children will be given. After depriving her of all rights as a married woman, if single and the owner of property, he has taxed her to support a government which recognizes her only when her property can be made profitable. He has monopolized nearly all the profitable employments, and from those she is permitted to follow, she receives but a scanty remuneration. He closes against her all the avenues to wealth and distinction which he considers most honorable to himself. As a teacher of theology, medicine, or law, she is not known. He has endeavored in every way that he could to destroy her confidence in her powers, to lessen her self-respect, and to make her willing to lead a dependent and abject life. Now, in view of this entire disenfranchisement of one half of the people of this country, their social and religious degradation, in view of the unjust laws above mentioned, and because women do feel themselves aggrieved, oppressed, and fraudulently deprived of their most sacred rights, we insist that they have immediate admission to all the rights and privileges which belong to them as citizens of the United States. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And that was the Declaration of Sentiments. And this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. And today we are celebrating and talking about the ratification of the 19th Amendment. And it's interesting because we think, you might think you know quite a bit about what happened at that time or who the people that pushed the passage and ratification. But when visiting the National Women's Rights Museum in Seneca Falls, you get to learn about some of the founding mothers that aren't necessarily in our history books. So Sarah, we're going to jump into a short clip with an interview I did with one of the rangers at the National Women's Rights National Historic Park. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX, and here we go to Seneca Falls. Park, from your perspective as the ranger.
Sure. But just to give you some background, of course, Women's Rights National Historical Park was created in December 1980 by Congress. And okay. The entire point of it is to protect the history, this being the most formal location point of the women's movement towards the struggle for equalities. So you first come on in and you are greeted by three ladies dressed in antebellum clothes. It's 1840s, of course. And of course, Frederick Douglass is here with the ladies. He was invited to attend. But to get us started, we actually need to start with Elizabeth K. Stanton, who stands next to him. Along with, who's next to her, Lucretia Mott, will meet up at the World Convention. It's the Anti-Slavery Convention in London.
Oh, okay.
Actually, Elizabeth K. Stanton is on her honeymoon with her husband when they're at this convention. And these two ladies meet because they're at this convention, and the first day was they spent just discussing what to do with the ladies. We're supposed to be here talking about slavery, how to handle this issue, and they spend it all talking about what to do with the ladies in the crowd. Mm-hmm. And they end with, well, they can sit here, but they're going to be up in a balcony and be quiet. Well,
so at the convention to end slavery, the people running the convention didn't know how to handle having women present at the conference.
Yeah, it was just not a topic that you would discuss in mixed company.
But did Katie Stanton and her husband go on their honeymoon purposely there to attend the convention?
So her husband, yes, is a strong abolitionist speaker. Okay. So there is this tie, and that's what most of these have a background in. Lucretia Mott is already a big name, too, by the time this convention's, the World Anti-Slavery Convention's happening in London. She has a huge following for abolitionist movement as well. Mm. And her, along with her sister, who is amongst the crowd, Martha Wright, Jane Hunt, and Marianne McClintock, they all are Quakers, and they're all huge in the abolitionist movement. And then Elizabeth K. Stanton, along with her husband, are going to be huge in that, too. So they're, of course, going there, part of their honeymoon, part of the reason. And yeah, this kind of infuriates them, though. That entire day that we could have talked about how to handle the issue of slavery, we discussed what to do with the ladies. Do we not have the same rights then? And everything. So it starts this really... Elizabeth K. Stanton writes that she is fascinated by Lucretia Mott, that she will listen to anything that she will say, and they decide that they'll do something about this when they get home. But when they get home, schedules get in the way, of course. Lucretia Mott is famous. She's out giving her speeches. She's out doing her thing. And Elizabeth K. Stanton is now home, still in the abolition movement and everything, but she now is starting to have children. So it's going to be some time before they meet up again. And Elizabeth K. Stanton actually was living up in Boston. She moves out here a year before the convention is to be held in 1847. And Lucretia Mott's going to come up to visit. So this is on July 9th of 1848. Lucretia Mott is going to be here. And over at Jane Hunt's house, they actually are going to have a day where everyone's meeting up. While they're there, they're just talking. And this fires up the fuel again. It's 8 years later, and they start discussing this, and they finally decide they are going to do something about this. They are going to have a convention 10 days after they come up with this plan. Of course, they do have a lot of support. Lucretia Mott's husband, James Mott, he was very supportive of it, along with Richard Hunt and even Marianne McClintock's husband. Now, Elizabeth K. Stanton's husband, he's away right at this moment, so we're not fully sure like what his thoughts are. But of course, one of the first things that they do is actually one of the McClintock's daughters. They start sending out some newspapers, get publicity out there, tell people about this convention we're about to have, and they invite Frederick Douglass to make sure that he will be there as well. He was a very strong supporter of the women's rights movement. Mm-hmm. So they get it out. Thanks to having a strong Quaker network, news will travel fast. So they'll sit down and try to actually figure out what is it that we want to address. We know we're going to have a women's rights convention. They decide to mimic the Declaration of Independence, with now the Declaration of Sentiments. So they are going to address these grievances in this way, and they do. They map it all out, and it's a beautiful document. I would encourage folks to fully read it. I could not do it justice in this little bit of time.
And the Declaration of Sentiments was kind of the foundation or the cornerstone of what the convention went on to be. And it was really just a small group of women who came up with this.
Yeah, it's crazy. Okay. It really was five people who had an idea, the support of theirs, like others in the community as well, because without that support, it would have just been the five of you, them. And when they show up here on July 19th, and they estimate approximately 300 people are there. The first day was supposed to be reserved for the ladies only, but quite a few gentlemen showed up, so they allowed them to attend. And day one, they reviewed the Declaration of Sentiments along with some talks from like Lucretia Mott and other co-ers. And then day two, they fully review it and vote on these resolutions. And most of them were unanimous. The one that gets the pushback, though, is the right to vote.
Really?
Yes. It seems
pushback from other women?
Quite a few people. Lucretia Mott actually will make a comment that they'll be seen as crazy if it's a little bit too far. Like, okay. So everything else, it's okay, but this one is one step up. So they want to make sure that they can actually put this out there without being seen as like a little bit crazy out there. But Frederick Douglass will be like, how do you expect to get anything else? They're looking for property rights. They're looking for education, rights to their own wages, to have jobs throughout. And in their own words, to no longer be civilly dead in the eyes of the law. So if they expect to get any laws made, then they're going to have the right to vote, put people in there that will provide them with these rights. So he really pushes for it. And sure enough, it will pass with a majority. And that is that cornerstone document then that we all have with that key phrase. We all know the one from the Declaration of Independence of all men are created equal. Now in the Declaration of Sentiments, it's all men and women are created equal. And Elizabeth K. Stanton wrote out that document, which is an amazing piece of history that we have here. And of the approximately 300 people that show up, 100 people will actually sign it. And it'll be 68 women and 32 males who will sign it off. So it's quite amazing. And Elizabeth K. Stanton will go on to continue to talk about women's rights. Herself, though, having seven kids, she can't really go far. She tells us that she feels like a caged lioness.
So, say it again.
A caged lioness.
Okay.
Yeah, she's stuck inside her home. She has to take care of all the household chores and everything. 1851 is when she meets Susan B. Anthony. And Susan B. Anthony is able to take her words and take them to the nation. So, and other conventions will follow talking about women's rights. 2 weeks later, Rochester will have one. The biggest ones will pop up about 2 years later in Massachusetts. There will be one as well. So it's, and most of the folks that attended the first convention, they're not attending because, oh, women's rights, yeah, yeah, yeah. They're like, women's rights, what are they talking about? They're curious to hear, what is this new idea of what they are?
What could women possibly need? And yeah. What I find interesting also is that these were mostly women of means,
yes.
Right, who were considered to be very comfortable, and what more could they want or possibly need to have because their lives are so easy. And the other thing that's interesting is when this started, it was 1848.
Yes.
And the right to vote didn't pass until 1920, so this is the beginning of a long movement.
Unfortunately, Elizabeth K. Stanton, Susan B. Anthony won't even get to see that right at all.
So was it because...
If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you're hearing a bit of my conversation with one of the rangers from the Women's Rights National Historic Park in Seneca Falls. Today is, of course, the 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote. And I thought it'd be interesting today to talk about some of those women who don't get a lot of press. We might hear their name briefly, but not really know much about them as people. Because like in all great revolutions, it's actually ordinary people that make things happen. It's not necessarily one leader that comes forward and drags people along with them. It's usually a lot of ordinary people who have had enough and come together and do extraordinary things. And that's definitely what was happening during the suffragist movement, because it's important to remember that the
idea that these women even gathered together to speak about the government was outrageous. It was a huge act of disobedience against the government. And without the support of their husbands, they could have been jailed or shamed or removed from the religious community for speaking out. It was a huge risk that these women took by not only speaking out, but signing the Declaration of Sentiments or taking actions. And one of the women that doesn't get talked about very much is Alice Paul. And you might recognize her name, but not really quite know why. But Alice Paul actually lived from 1885 to 1977. She died at 92, and she had lived through two waves of the feminist movement and many of the civil rights movements. And she was active the entire time. And the thing about Alice Paul, one, was she was a Quaker, like many of the people who were involved in the suffragists and women's rights movement, very dedicated to public service. Her mother was a suffragist. She attended Swarthmore at a time that very few women got any sort of education. But Alice Paul was incredibly activated in the movement, but she was the radical. You know, she wasn't a mom of seven children or with the husband of a large standing in the society. She was a radical activist. She was arrested seven times. She was imprisoned three times. She was imprisoned in England protesting and marching for women's rights. And there she actually learned some tactics to help gain more attention for their movement, like demanding to be treated like a political prisoner when she was arrested. Because if you're considered a political prisoner, then you have different rights than a regular prisoner, where you're not having to wear prison gear or they can't force feed you. And by stating that she was a political prisoner and by refusing to wear prison garb, it actually led to her being forcibly changed by the women guards in the prison. And when they couldn't change her, they brought in the male guards. And that was such a horrific experience. It gained huge national attention that these male guards had stripped down Alice Paul to force her to wear a prison outfit. And then she also was very involved in hunger strikes and led hunger strikes in the prison because it would reduce the amount of time that they had to serve. And it also gained more attention for the movement. And actually, the last time she went to prison, the prison warden had her force-fed, which caused her great bodily harm and also brought great attention to the movement. And I bring this up because where we are right now is at a time when there is a lot of lawless disobedience happening, a lot of disrespect, a lot of scary, chaotic, radical marching and shouting and destruction of property. And it feels scary and it feels overwhelming. And there are some factions of the movements that are happening all over the country that are just trying to stir up trouble. But there are other huge factions that are just trying to make good trouble, to quote John Lewis. They're trying to get attention. And nice, peaceful, orderly acts of disobedience don't get attention. And one of the biggest things that Alice Paul did was that she organized a half million person march in Washington, D.C. the day before President Wilson's inauguration. And she went to the D.C. officials to get permission to have this parade, this procession, to go down the middle of Pennsylvania Avenue. And the government didn't want that. They didn't want all of these women making a spectacle right before the inauguration. They didn't see it as respectful. But she was able to get permission. But then the D.C. officials failed to have sufficient police protection for the women that were marching. And there ended up being a near riot on Pennsylvania Avenue with a half million people, some opponents, some supporters, yelling and pushing and throwing things. And a lot of the officers actually stepped aside and kind of let the near riot take place and ended up having to be stopped by the National Guard. And Alice Paul found that that act, that movement, that parade, although it was considered an illegal act and it was deviant and disobedient and against the civility of our nation, was what kept the suffragist movement in the eye of the culture, of the community, of the political forces. They didn't want to see women throwing themselves into the streets, going on hunger strikes, and it forced them to make change. No change is easy. And although the women's suffragist movement is considered a bloodless revolution, it still was one that was filled with women who are willing to put their bodies on the line in some way to make sure that the message was received. So I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX, and we're talking about the ratification of the 19th Amendment today. And although we aren't taking calls, you can still call in with a thought or comment to 805-549-8855, and Sarah will pass the information along to me. And I'd like to play a little bit more of another song from 1916 called Winning the Vote. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We'll be back to continue our conversation.
I've been down to Madison to see the folks and sights. You'd laugh, I'm sure, to hear them talk about the women's rights. Now it's just as plain as my old hat, as plain can be, that if the women want the vote, they'll get no help from me. Not from Joe, not from Joe, if he knows it, not from Joseph, no, 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 not from Joe, not from me, I tell you, no.
Say, friend Joseph, why not we should vote as well as you? Are there no problems in this state that need our wisdom too? We must pay our taxes same as you, as citizens be true. And if some wicked thing we do, to jail we're sent by you. Yes, we are, same as you, and you know it, don't you, Joseph? Yes, you do, yet you boast you'll not help us win the vote.
But dear woman, can't you see your home is your true sphere? Just think of going to the polls, perhaps two times a year. You are wasting time you ought to use in sewing and at work. Your home neglected all those hours. Would you such duty shirk? Help from Joe, help from Joe, if he knows it, not from Joseph. No, 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 not from Joe, not from me, I tell you, no.
Joseph, tell us something new, we're tired of that old song. We'll sew the seams and cook the meals, to vote won't take us long. We will help clean house the one too large for man to clean alone. The state and nation, don't you see, when we the vote have won. Yes, we will, and you'll help.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. And that's a song from 1916 called Winning the Vote, 4 years before the ratification of the 19th Amendment. And today we're talking about some of those ordinary women who did extraordinary things over the course of 70 years before the passage or the adoption ratification of the 19th Amendment. And so I have another short clip talking about another key player that we rarely hear about, and that's Martha Wright. She was the sister of Lucretia Mott. And Martha, her home was actually part of the Underground Railroad. She housed a lot of escaping slaves, and she was very good friends with Harriet Tubman, but you don't hear much about what she was doing as one of the five founding women. So let's jump back into my conversation at the Women's Rights National Historic Park with one of the rangers there. We continue our conversation talking about the founding mothers, including well-known pioneers Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, Lucretia Mott, and her sister, Martha Wright. Martha Wright, who scandalously attended the first convention 7 months pregnant and went on to be an outspoken activist throughout her life.
I know that there is pain, but you hold on for one more day and you break free, break from the chain. Someday somebody's gonna make you wanna turn around and say goodbye.
Like to, because we're talking about how the women who inspired change throughout our history had to have the right family of origin, had to have come from the right part of the country. So what were a few of the factors that created Martha Wright's confidence in speaking her mind?
So She was actually, from what I'm learning more about her, she was actually more of a writer. And I think it was definitely her Quaker upbringing and definitely her kind of background that really set the stage for the rest of the convention and the rest of the events that happened. So she was the youngest child of her parents, Thomas and Anna. And Lucretia Mott being her older sister, she constantly was like surrounded with the Quaker influence and kind of the faith that kind of shaped how she went about her life. But she really was the youngest child. So like her parents and her other older siblings were doing all these amazing things. And she kind of, I don't want to say it was rebellious, but her personality was much more abrasive than girls during that time. And she really kind of didn't let that abrasive personality let people kind of put her down because of that. And she kind of embraced it and really went about her life with the rest of that personality. So unfortunately, her first husband passed away, but she really kind of decided to break away from the pact in a kind of literal way, because she, the rest of her family living in Philadelphia, she was the only one of her family members who moved to Auburn, which is upstate New York. Yeah, so really kind of shifted from the rest of the traditional gear, and that really kind of cemented her place. And this place in New York specifically being centered around reform, she took an active role with her children kind of growing up and making sure that they knew right from wrong, because she was still a woman of the time. She was definitely taking a role in the household, and she definitely was making sure all of these things were happening, but she was doing it in a way that she could kind of balance her writing and kind of her humor with the rest of the movement. And once her children were old enough to take care of themselves or at boarding school kind of learning Quaker mannerisms and Quaker values, even though she wasn't Quaker technically, she still instilled those into them. She went out and she did so much work. She chaired several of the conventions. She was a secretary for many of them. So her writing, like her just sarcasm and her pure kind of personality, it's very raw and it's very organic in kind of her letters to family, kind of the minutes from the meetings, and symbolized just who she was as a woman, but also kind of the movement as a whole, and really that these women weren't, they were going to make sure that their voices were heard, and that's what Martha was kind of doing. It was very indirect, like not a lot of people know about her and kind of her story, but she was one of the greater women who made up one of the greater pictures of the movement. And so I think like she's one of my favorite, if not one my favorite woman here depicted out of the five, just because she exemplifies kind of that personality in which she does not care what people think of her. She did not care what her neighbors thought of her, being a very dangerous woman, as they would often call her. So really, I don't know, she's just a great person to kind of talk about and kind of discuss, because not a lot of people know about her. And she's really, that's really what this park does, is talk about not a lot of the things that we're familiar with in traditional United States history. Is really kind of, definitely, I love Martha. She's really cool.
If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You're listening to a clip from my conversation with one of the rangers at the Women's Rights National Historic Park in Seneca Falls. If you ever have a chance to visit that part of upstate New York, please do. It's beautiful. It's fascinating. And being able to walk through this National Historic Park where the first Women's Rights Convention took place is incredibly empowering and inspiring. And I really want to keep emphasizing that these women were radical. They were not polite. They were disobedient. They were arrested. They were dangerous. And there was a lot of pushback against these women who were out marching in the streets and participating in hunger strikes and writing divisive letters and also speaking out in public. And that's one of the things that was interesting about Elizabeth Cady Stanton's friendship with Susan B. Anthony. They were best friends for many, many years. Some historians say that they spent more time together than they did with their actual spouses. They were so committed to the movement. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton was the mother of seven, and she was incredibly organized, and she was a phenomenal writer, having written the Declaration of Sentiments. And Susan B. Anthony had all the panache. She was able to work up an audience to get people to listen. But at the time, women weren't allowed by law to speak in public spaces. So they had to find different locations that would allow women to speak in public. And many of those were friendship houses of the Quakers or at the spiritualist center, which would allow women to speak. But these were not polite women who were behaving nicely in civilized ways. These are women who were on the cutting edge of society, pushing for change and recognition. And so I'd like to play one more clip, Sarah. There's a little bit of a song by Etta James, and this is from Schoolhouse Rock, of all things. And Schoolhouse Rock put together the song Suffering Till Suffrage, and this is Etta James singing. We're going to listen to a little bit of this song, and we'll be back with another clip. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. That's Etta James singing Suffering Till Suffrage from Schoolhouse Rock. And we're talking about the ratification of the 19th Amendment that happened on this day, August 18th in 1920. And although, you know, it was passed by Congress on June 4th in 1919, it took time to get it ratified. It actually came down to one vote in Tennessee, which made the difference of having the amendment ratified. And the congressman in Tennessee, his last name was Byrne, had a conversation with his mother the morning of the vote, and her words changed his mind and got him to change his vote, which brought about the ratification of that amendment. So I'd like to share with you one more conversation with the rangers, the young people that oversee the Women's Rights National Historic Park in Seneca Falls. We'll talk a little bit more about some of those ordinary people who did extraordinary things.
All of you are kind of millennial age. Do you feel hopeful that your generation will have a movement? You know, will there be something that your generation is remembered for more than the technology? What are your thoughts?
I mean, it really is just learning about the history and just kind of history repeats itself. So you really just have to kind of take in what these women did and kind of just apply it, treating people the way you would like to be treated, the golden rule, and really kind of going onwards from there. And I personally think that's what I do. I learn from, I interpret the history, I listen to the history, and that's what I kind of apply to my daily life.
So is there something like Newton or Quinton that you love about this place or the stories that you want me to know that I wouldn't even know to ask?
So right now I'm working on a project incorporating the story of Indigenous women into this story in the Haudenosaunee Nation here.
Are they in New York?
Right, sort of the northeast, going into Canada as well. But a lot of those traditional cultures which are still living today, were very matriarchal, where women sort of chose who the chiefs were and had the power to depose those chiefs as well. And they were in contact with some of those white feminists here as well. So just incorporating all sides of the story is what I like doing.
Oh, that'd be fascinating. So the Indigenous families that were here in the 1800s, did they interact peacefully with the Quakers and the residents? Or, I mean, was there a cooperative that was happening at the time?
Yeah, they were definitely sort of interacting with each other socially, economically, in all sorts of different ways.
So do you think that the original suffragists learned or saw the way these families, the Indigenous families, were operating and said, we need to be more partnered like that?
I think they definitely saw it as an alternative and as another way of looking at things. So they were very familiar with it.
Tell me the name of the tribe again.
It's the Haudenosaunee people. So it's actually five or six different tribal nations sort of in one confederacy. The Iroquois is another name for it.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
And one lady who kind of gets written out who helped with the Haudenosaunee is Matilda Jocelyn Gage. Yeah, she's kind of like that third person in the Elizabeth K. Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, and then it's Matilda Jocelyn Gage. And she did a ton of work. They actually have her house that you can go see over in
Fayetteville,
New York. And she was big in the women's rights movement, but she was also big in the local tribes issues that were going on around here. I mean, any social issue, she basically had her hand in. And she's one of those ladies that was a little bit overlooked by history, that we should probably know her as a household name, but she unfortunately didn't make it into the books.
We need every little town and community needs their, I mean, we have historical societies, but maybe all the historical societies need to incorporate a more balanced history.
That, or to me, it's one of those things where each small town has a piece of the story, mm-hmm. and I would love to have like a little bit of a big database that connects each small town with each small town, because I know they do highlight, at least in a couple of places I've been especially, that there are women's stories, like strong, powerful stories there, but they don't connect it with the next woman's story, or they don't connect it with how does this fit into the greater story of everything. And it seems like we are proud of our history.
The question I always ask people about this part of the country is, it why does Rochester, Seneca Falls, upstate New York, it's like a spiritual center. What is it about this part? And this about this part of New York, because, you know, Rochester was the start of the psychotherapy movement. This is like the Mecca for psychotherapists and talk therapy and Carl Rogers. Have you thought about that? Like, why this part of the world?
So it's traditionally going into a lot of kind of the burned over district of this area.
And explain what that is, because Rebecca tried to educate me.
So the burned over district, essentially there was, it's a nickname in upstate New York, which is essentially that this area was so burned over with religious reform and kind of religious fever that it was burned over. Too much was happening at one time and really stirred a lot of these different movements and kind of ideas. And with any religious movement comes many new social ideas. So you can look, civil rights movement, huge religious influence there. A lot of different things that happened throughout history are kind of guided by religion. And so with the spiritualist movement in particularly, it was kind of started in Rochester, and really the Fox sisters played a pivotal role into that, Kate and Maggie Fox. So really, like the McClintocks, the table where the Declaration of Sentiments was drafted, that's where seances were held. So a lot of different like interactive things that happened within this area, because a lot of these Quakers believed that there was kind of the spiritualist movement. They could communicate with the dead, and it really played into these new ideas.
So the Quakers seem to be at the beginning of all of these things, spiritualism, the women's movement. Why? But the Quakers were anti-military or government. So what was it about the Quakers that started and influenced all of these movements?
I would definitely have to say, I'm not a Quaker expert, but I have to definitely...
You should be, because it's fascinating.
Yeah. Definitely from my kind of personal research, it's just because of their religious viewpoints. They don't discriminate based on sex or race, and so it's really kind of pivotal, and they're taught that from the beginning, like as young children, and they carry that over into their adult life. And that's what a lot of these Quakers were doing and kind of with their teachings, and they were really about a lot of co-educational things. So there was no discrimination when it came to women being in the same classroom as boys and learning the same material as them. They would learn different things. Women would learn to sew, and men would learn like land surveying, but that's two different fields, I guess. But still, they were really integrated into both aspects of kind of man and woman. Same thing with race as well. Like Frederick Douglass was often in attendance at Martha Wright's home, and she actually said, "You can come and stay in my home." Even though she wasn't Quaker, she still practiced Quaker beliefs. So it really just kind of, they did not discriminate. And that's what they were basically trying to convey. And that's what a lot of these people who weren't Quakers were starting to adapt their kind of thinking and their morals. And especially Lucretia Mott tried to instill that into Elizabeth Cady Stanton, saying you can't start a movement until you actually... or you can't have institutional change until you have kind of moral and social change in people. And that's essentially not what they were trying to do directly, but they were trying to basically say, find your inner light, let it speak to you. And a lot of it kind of resulted as a result of that.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and if you're just tuning in, that's part of my conversation with the Rangers at the Women's Rights National Historic Park in Seneca Falls that took place a few years ago. I love that part of the country, and I have been to the Women's Rights National Historic Park 4 different times. Each time I go, I learn something new, and it inspires me even more to do a deeper dive into the history of women's rights and into our families. You know, what we learn in school is the education that is deemed important to keep us moving forward as a capitalistic culture, but it's not necessarily a thorough history of really who we are as a people and who the ordinary people were that have driven cultural change. So I have so much more I'd love to share with you, but our time is limited, and I hope that this inspires you to maybe do a little bit of your own deep dive while we're home virtually teaching our children. Please take time to look at the resources that are available through the Women's Rights National Historic Park to learn about all the different women and the pioneers and frontiers women who were out changing this country and inspiring our growth and inspiring our laws, and also to hopefully inspire the movements that are happening right now. The passage, the ratification, took 70 years of many generations of women's efforts, mothers working with daughters, to see this through. You know, our work that was done in 1848 is still being built upon today. It's not separate movements. It's all the same movement with different generations putting their own spin on it. And what each generation continues to work for is equality for all, opportunities for all. And many people struggle with this idea of systemic racism or institutional racism. And it may be that no individual person is propagating racism, but it's the way we've allowed our institutions to develop, the way our laws are implemented, that continues to disenfranchise people from participating. So you may have the right to vote, but if you can't access a polling booth, or if you can't access your ballot, then you are still disenfranchised. We might have laws in place that protect women for earning equal pay, but if the system doesn't support women accessing those jobs, then we still have problems of inequality in our country. So I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist, and I hope that you'll continue diving in. You can listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org under the programs tab or podcast my show. You can leave me a message through email, elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com, or on my Instagram or Facebook page. And I'm going to leave you today with a little Dolly Parton singing about the 19th Amendment. Thank you for listening and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. CBX.
Women's Suffrage Amendment ratified.
Women have been fighting for the legal right to vote since the 1840s. In 1890, the National American Women's Suffrage Association, NAWSA, was established with Susan B. Anthony its leading force. But women have been fighting for their rights since the very beginning of time. First they said we couldn't dance, then said we couldn't drink. And unless a man allowed it, they said we couldn't think. They said we shouldn't speak till we were spoken to. Well, there was just so much back then we weren't allowed to do. But the first bite of that apple, I guess, revealed the truth. That's when Eve got smart, and that's why Adam don't like fruit. But that old tree of knowledge had some limbs that broke. We had to fight for women's rights. They said we couldn't vote.